mother, who are they to judge us? Simply 'cause our hair is long.
Devon Gilfillian on Undercurrents with Inner City Blues, Make Me Wanna Holler. Geneva Magnus preceded that with That's What Love Will Make You Do. And the OJs started that set with When the World's at Peace. You're listening to Undercurrents. I'm Gabriela. Stay tuned because we've got Robbie Robertson coming up in just a minute.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre, a place where quality is key. It's important for the world and future generations to understand the power of art and music. Ultimately, we are doing our part to carry on tradition. Tune into Passing Sound, the first Saturday of each month at 10 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, or KBOO.fm, where we make musical structures for the listener to enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. What happens when Eastern mysticism and Western rites of passage collide? The search for enlightenment, with its storms, lulls, and occasional thrills, is not that different from the search for the perfect surfer's wave. In his personal study on the elusive nature of mystical experience and its ability to evade the intellect, this week's guest weaves together scientific research, the words of religious scholars and poets, and the wisdom of surfers and monks. Our guest today is Jamal Yogis, author of the book All Our Waves Are Water, Stumbling Toward Enlightenment and the Perfect Ride. A graduate of Columbia's Journalism School, Jamal's magazine reporting has won awards like the 2005 Leslie Rachel Sanders Award for Social Justice Reporting, a 2007 Maggie Award for Best Magazine Feature, and two Scripps Howard Reporting Scholarships. In 2010, the Commonwealth Club voted him the new face of San Francisco media for his popular writing in San Francisco Magazine. His stories have also been published in ESPN Magazine, Afar, Runner's World, The Surfer's Journal, The Washington Post, The Chicago Tribune, and many others. He has been a guest lecturer at UC Berkeley, Columbia University, and San Francisco State. A few years ago, Jamal was on this Pathways show for an interview about his first book, Saltwater Buddha, a coming-of-age memoir about running away from home to surf and then nearly becoming a Zen monk. Hello, Jamal, and welcome back to the Pathways program.
Hi, Paul. Nice to be here.
Well, you are so eclectic, and I've got to ask you, how do you define yourself these days? Especially after reading this latest book, I mean, do you think of yourself primarily as a journalist or a memoirist, a spiritual teacher, an adventure travel writer? What?
That's the million-dollar question, Paul. I have a hard time putting a box around myself. And to some extent, I guess I've cultivated that. I get frustrated with boxes because I think so much of the best or the rich stuff is in the interdisciplinary thinking and experiencing. And, you know, we're multifaceted beings, and we have sides of ourselves that are logical and that are artistic and that are devotional. And some people are able to sort of focus increasingly on one of those as a career, and I've been more of a mutt. So these days, I mean, I identify, I guess, if I were talking about strictly, you know, my career, what I make money from is I'm a writer. You know, that's my bread and butter career. But I, you know, I'm writing about my own life, and I'm writing about big philosophical and spiritual questions. And I also consider some of that writing that I do journalism. And so, you know, I'm working hard to be undefinable.
Okay, well, you're doing a very good job. Now, let's talk about your current book, All Our Waves Are Water. Is this, how is it different than Saltwater Buddha, for instance? Is this like a sequel?
Well, it's something of a follow-on, because it picks up time-wise where Saltwater Buddha left off. Saltwater Buddha started off when I was about 16, ran away from home as I was getting into trouble, to Maui to learn to surf, and then was introduced to meditation and thought I wanted to be a Zen monk. And it covers a period of time up until my early 20s. And this one picks up basically where I dropped off there. And in this one, I'm doing my last year of college in India. And my girlfriend of 3 years, who I've been planning the trip with, who's Indian American, has just left me. And I'm flat on my face, feeling that pain that, you know, of a first heartbreak that you think no human should have to feel. And it's similar in Saltwater Buddha to Saltwater Buddha in that I'm telling short stories about my own life, often that have some philosophical or spiritual lesson to them, that I learned usually by making a bunch of big mistakes. But this one is different in that Saltwater Buddha, I really I tried to keep to the frame of Zen Buddhism for the most part, and surfing. And in my second book, which I didn't actually talk with you about, I wrote about the neuroscience of fear. So I went really deep into science, which was fascinating. But in this third book, I wanted to get back to storytelling, because after being steeped in science for 3+ years, getting to interview a bunch of neuroscientists, particle physicists, etc., I realized, wow, how much we know, it's incredible, and how little we know. you know this well. The more we know, the more we know we don't know. And so many of the big questions of what is consciousness, and how is reality even being formed, are still big questions, and there is much the territory of, well, I felt like I was getting as much out of the ancient wisdom traditions as I was from the scientists on those big questions, and I wanted to go back and include all of those. And in addition, my dad was dying during the time I was writing All Our Waves Are Water of cancer, and so I was really thrown into the big questions of faith. And I didn't want to limit myself to a box. So in this book, I bring in interfaith dialogue, trips to Jerusalem, trips to India, trips to Indonesia, science. So I just wanted to bring, I guess, wrap everything in and leave it all on the court, so to speak, because I think seeing my dad on his deathbed, really over the 4 years that I was writing this, he was in and out of, we thought he might be going. I thought, you know, I want to really share with readers my true experience. And so that's what I tried to do here. So I guess it's just a little broader frame than Saltwater Buddha.
Right. Okay. So what is your primary purpose in writing a book like this? I mean, everybody has life lessons, and a lot of people are intelligent enough to think about it and derive meaning from their experiences and maybe tie it in with some philosophical research or some meditation attempts or whatever they get into. But what Well, are you modeling something for your readers? I mean, what is your purpose in writing your story? Are you taking a position that there's something particularly special about your story? Of course there is. Every story is unique. But what is your primary purpose in writing a book like this that's so personal? It has a lot of your reflections, some of the things you've learned. Are you modeling that for your readers? Should they do that too?
I don't think they should do what I've done. I think what I, but they should, you know, learn from the difficult times. And I think what I do partly for myself is I go back and look at my life and I look at where I really learned something important. And I retell that to myself, that story. And in it, I try to make it entertaining and fun because, you know, we're story animals. And this is the way we learn. Whether you're looking at the Bible or Greek mythology or literature, it's like the stories that endure and are repeated and that give us meaning are generally not just, there are some like the Tao Te Ching that are more like treaties and sort of this is the way things are, but a lot of them are stories, and stories are powerful modes of understanding for us. And so I could tell stories about anybody, and I think they could have meaning. And
or you could write fiction, or you could just write fiction.
Yeah, and I have tried writing fiction, and I have some. but I think the stories that are easiest, I think experience is to some extent universal, but we're all looking at different, looking through the prism of our own experiences. And the experiences I know best are my own. So if I'm going to tell a story, well, that's what I have. It's sort of like, in meditation, you know, you could meditate on anything, but your breath is there. It's always there.
Right.
And so you, it's a focus. And when I wrote Saltwater Buddha, I never planned on being a memoirist, but I wrote a story that was about meditation and surfing, and it resonated with people. And then a publisher said, "Do you want to write a book about this?" And I said, "Yes, but I don't want to be a guru, because I guess I feel like I don't know all the answers. I'm just learning myself. But if I can write a story that talks about my own experiences, I can bring the reader into that experience." And I think experience is where we find wisdom. You know, it's getting out of our intellectual conjecture alone that I think we can really have embodied wisdom. And so I try to do that with stories. You know, I don't know if I succeed or not, but
so,
that's the idea.
Speaking of your avowed desire to not set yourself up as a guru, you have become a meditation teacher and a lecturer with a spiritual bent, have you not?
I have, and I've ended up in that place. Even though I resisted it to begin with, and that was part of why I was taking a story format, is to be able to be honest about my own shortcomings and show that it's often in the shortcomings where there is deep learning, because you have to go inside and find some inner resilience.
And how did you become a meditation teacher? I know that you were attracted to doing meditation retreats, and you spent time in McLeod Ganj, where the Dalai Lama lives in India. By the way, I've been there too. It's an amazing place. And you had some retreat experiences. How did you segue into becoming a meditation teacher yourself?
Well, it's a bit new for me, but long story short, I did a number of retreats in various monasteries over the years, and have continued doing them and studying with a fairly regular stream of teachers. And then a friend of mine who's a psychologist who teaches mindfulness at places like Kripalu and Spirit Rock, and is a bit older than me, and a mentor of mine, basically said, hey, do you want to teach a retreat together? And I was very resistant, actually, and at first, because, or I was torn, rather, because I didn't want to be saying, hey, I'm, you know, I understand. I've gone all the way to enlightenment, and now you can too. And if you buy this retreat, you know, I'm going to get you there. But I thought, you know, teaching is the best way to learn. And if I come at teaching the same way that I come at my writing, which is very honestly, and just saying, hey, I'm a student of the path, and I have some experience, maybe more than some of my students, maybe less, but I'm coming at it as, hey, we're here to wake up together and learn together, and that there's something special about when we all practice together in community. And so that's the way I come at retreat. And I've, you know, I've only taught a handful.
Okay.
And so so it's new territory for me, Paul.
Okay. Now, getting to the book, All Our Waves Are Water, in has a lot to. You use surfing as a metaphor for navigating the spiritual path or the personal development path of life. Why don't we start with the title of the book, All Our Waves Are Water? What do waves represent? What does water represent?
It's one of those titles that you can come at on multiple levels, but the first one is really when I was learning to meditate and learning to surf around the same time at about 16, I realized that thoughts move a lot like waves, and that I'm not creating them, much like the ocean isn't just, you know, consciously creating each wave. They're more arriving, they're coming through. And that when you're caught, our normal way of being is just to be sort of caught in the churn of our own thoughts and identifying with them. But when you sit in meditation or use other practices where you're aware of your own mind, you take a step back and you have a choice not to identify with those spiraling thoughts. And just that awareness and stopping the automatic identification process is very powerful, I've found. And so I love that metaphor.
I think what the metaphor is saying, or what the way I'm reading it, is that we tend to identify ourselves as the particle or as the wave, whereas we can also identify in a much broader way and identify with the water or the sea. And there's this quote that you have in the book by Rumi that goes like this: we are not a drop in the ocean, we are an ocean in a drop. That's the sense of your title, right?
Yeah, and Rumi nailed it. And exactly. I mean, there is a this is something that you know, great mystics and philosophers have come at in various ways, and it can be a little hard to put your finger on, but the oceanic metaphor is a tangible way of looking at it. And even the way water moves, where it has its own uniqueness, just like you and I are unique, and that's part of its beauty, but it's always water. And a tsunami can be water, a ripple can be water, and so that fundamental substance is still there. And so you can really grasp that ultimate and relative level of practice, I think.
And surfing is such a great metaphor for staying in balance no matter what's happening in the sea. Sometimes it's dangerous, sometimes it's calm, sometimes it's stormy. And I like the way you say surfing is like Zen for the stormy world, because you need balance, you need patience, you're in the water, you're on the water, and every once in a while you ride a wave.
Yeah, I mean, it's really helpful. When you go out, you can't bring your cell phone. So it has a contemplative nature on its own, because you're out there with nature. But sometimes the sea is serene, or you're feeling comfortable out there and it's peaceful, and other times your shoulders are burning and you're just trying to get through the whitewash. And so it is a lot like life, and I've always, but it's playful, and you can bring that playful mindset to surfing where even the challenges are part of the game. And I try to bring that back onto land because it's like, hey, well, I remembered when my shoulders are burning and surfing, I could still laugh about it, but here I am, and it's part of the challenge and part of the fun. It's what makes the ride satisfying.
I think some of your surfing stories in Bali and other places are just really hilarious and very very revealing of these deep truths. Now, before we forget, I want to talk about some of the characters in the book, particularly this one character, your friend Sonam. And I love the way that you learn things from people, whether they're a friend or whether they're a teacher or maybe they're a fellow surfer. But tell us about this Tibetan character Sonam, because he really had an impact on you.
Yeah, he's been one of my best teachers, even though he was a friend and peer as well. Like I said, I'm heartbroken in the beginning of the book. I'm wandering India, and I meet Sonam, who happens to be heartbroken too, but he's a Tibetan monk, and he's lost track of his family through the occupation of Tibet. And one, the pivotal moment for me really came, we would hike in the hills, and we saw some snow as it was melting in the spring, and he picked it up one day and he said, "This snow, many, many thinking Tibet, my family missing home." And he had tears in his eyes, and I put my arm around him and I said, "Sonam, I'm so sorry you can't go home." And he laughed in that moment, and he looked at me with genuine surprise, and he said, "Jama, you funny, this very sad, no problem."
And
it was one of those moments where you can talk about all our waves are water. Yeah, you can have angry thoughts and happy thoughts, and they're all of a similar nature. But that's kind of an idea until you see somebody embody it. And he was embodying that ability to stay connected to, I guess, his oceanic self that was in more constant joy, and also his relative state of real sadness, and able to embrace them together. And I don't know if I'd ever seen that in such a tangible way, and it became like a mantra for me, like, "This very sad, no problem," as I grieved the breakup.
Yeah, I mean, the way that he balances sadness and joy and doesn't like create a bigger problem around any of it is really quite an interesting story that you tell, and really gets across a lot of the points that you learned spiritually speaking. Now, let's talk about the spirituality and this concept of non-duality that you bring up.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about experiencing a state of fluid non-duality. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's the other million-dollar question. And I guess another reason that I use sort of story and prose to try to get at an experience that's ineffable. I mean, everybody says that you can have these, but you can have these moments in meditation or really doing many different things where you're completely immersed in a kind of flow state where there is a feeling of non-separation with the universe as a whole. And so one of the stories that I tell is being on a dream yoga retreat where I have this dream where basically I realize I've in the dream that I've been living inside this box, and I'm looking at the world through a slit in a box. And I'm at a picnic in the dream, and all of a sudden I realize that I don't need to be limited to this box, and my consciousness just rushes through the box and out into empty space. And it's funny because there is in the dream there's a feeling of awareness still, but there's also a feeling of being everywhere, kind of being the leaves, being the picnic itself. And it was a totally new experience for me, one that I'd never lived outside of this dream. But anyway, in yoga practice or in meditation, you have moments like this where you transcend the limitations of self and realize, well, there is another way of identifying that is much more free. And yet, at the same time, here we are in the relative world and needing to work and have responsibilities. And so how to hold that paradox is really what these non-dual schools like Zen and Vedanta teach. And it's one reason why I think a great teacher will tell his student to go into a deep meditation practice and then also say, if you're getting too attached to the one state of oneness, to say, hey, you got to go back to the marketplace too and do and do some work down there as well, because they're both true. There is a self and there is also no self. And the Buddha was very clear that you can't take an extreme view one way or the other, but they're both existing simultaneously. And so this is just my own experiences with that, but I'm still learning myself.
You know, I love the way that you kind of sum up the story with what I thought was a major lesson to take from it. And here's a quote from near the end of the book. I was pining after success as I'd pined after an imagined Sati, that girlfriend that left you in India. A Sati whom I put on a pedestal to try to fill the emptiness in myself. But just like then, the ordinary stuff that was already here, the ordinary quirks, the ordinary cage, the ordinary me, was good on its own if I didn't resist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that it's that resistance, I think, that excuse me, that becomes so much of the unnecessary suffering. And I mean, that Sodom's This Very Sad No Problem was, you know, contained that whole package in that simple phrase, because we don't realize how much we're pushing away sadness, fear, pain. And in the pushing away process, it creates a whole other subset of right. Wasted energy, spinning of the wheels, suffering, rather than just sort of letting the waves come through as they are. There right. are stormy days, there are calm days. And so I think as we begin spiritual practice, often we just want things to be easy, because right. we maybe see a teacher who's doing well or looks peaceful, and we just want to be there right away. And but really, the path, as I understand it, is much more about acceptance of what is now, and really
non-resistance. And speaking of non-resistance, I have to call this conversation to a close because we are running out of time, and I want to make sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is www.jamalyogis.com. And I'm going to spell your name because it's not obvious. JAIMALYOGIS.com. And people can find out about your work and your books there, etc. And I want to thank you very much for being on the show today, Jamal.
Thank you so much, Paul. Honored to be here.
And for those who tuned in late, this is your Pathways host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview anytime you like, or as a free podcast. Just search for Pathways or Paul O'Brien and you can find it. Today we've been visiting with Jamal Yogis, author of All Our Waves Are Water, Stumbling Toward Enlightenment and the Perfect Ride. I want to say thank you to all of our listeners for tuning into Pathways, which is broadcast and streamed worldwide via KBOO.fm, Sunday mornings at 8:30 a.m. USA Pacific Time. Podcasts of today's show, which you can listen to and forward to others, are available for free at divination.com, spelled divination.com, as well as via iTunes and other free podcast servers. This is Paul O'Brien reminding you to tell your friends about Pathways Radio and Podcasts. And thanks again to Jamal Yogis and to all of you listeners for tuning in and being a part of the Pathways experience.
Are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about